This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Baraj aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I am retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I have a surprise co-host this evening. This is last minute. I love it. I love it, Jude. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, well, that's great. I just happened to be here.
Yeah.
And big fan of yours.
Big, as am I of you.
Big fan of Mary Bacon.
Oh, yes. Well, we're going to get into this. This is going to be a great show.
And yeah, it's nice to be here.
Thank you, Jude. Thank you, Jude. And I would like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219 XM 206. And also to those of you listening to our website at horseracingradio.net. Now, a portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. Please visit the website if you're able to help, www.pdjf.org. Now, our guest this evening, not only a successful jockey, but a successful trainer, and now a successful agent. I can't wait to hear her story. With 514 wins as a rider and over $4 million in earnings, Paula Bacon, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So glad you can join us this evening, Paula. And as I mentioned in the introduction, you've worn many hats in the racing industry.
Yeah.
And can't wait to hear all about it. And you are somehow connected to Mary Bacon. Please fill us in on that.
You know, I'm actually not connected to her, but I guess you could say in a way she was married to Johnny Bacon, who was actually my stepfather. After my mother was married to Johnny, after Mary and Johnny got divorced, so he legally adopted me, so he became my stepfather, and that's obviously where I get my name. But the only connection I have, you know, is just that is he was married to her first before my mom.
Does she have any influence over your decision to become a rider?
Well, quite a bit, actually, because when I was a kid, you know, a little girl, she was just beautiful, like striking. And I followed her, you know, just because I was fascinated with her. Obviously, we have the same name. And I, you know, heard a million stories, you know, because Johnny and everything. But, yeah, I mean, I wanted to be just like her. I thought she was way cool.
She was pretty cool, and she had her picture on the cover of Sports Illustrated, and she was really a neat person. I didn't know her personally. I was probably in high school when she came to California to ride, but I remember the first time I saw her in the paddock at Del Mar, she had she was riding a horse with orange silks, and she had these orange panties with white polka dots on underneath her white pants, and you could see right through them. And I thought, wow, that's really cool that you would match your underwear to the silks, right? Well, I didn't know she used to do that all the time. Like, she wore green if she had a green. She must have changed her underwear like 9 times a day. And I thought that was like the coolest thing. I was totally taken by that, because, you know, I like to match my hats to my shirts and stuff like that. And I thought, wow, that's going the extra yard right there. But she was really cool. Always came to the paddock with a smile on her face, and I used to love watching her ride, and I read her book. There's a great story in her book about her, and I tell this story a lot to people that, you know, talk about girls riding and stuff. I've always been a fan of girls on the racetrack, and tried to help as many as I could when I was training horses to get mounts and start their careers. But she wrote about riding a pregnant mare one night when she was pregnant herself. And it was, to me, it's one of the greatest lines ever. She said, "The four of us finished last."
And it's true. That's actually a very true story.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite racetrack stories.
That's fantastic. Paula, did you learn to match your underwear to your silks as well?
No. I tried to fly under the radar that way a little bit. Mary was way more on the attention-seeking side than I was, which I won't hold that against her. It certainly got her pleased.
That is awesome. That is awesome. She sounds like such a great person to learn from and spend time with, and obviously a great influence in your life and career. And so tell us how that happened, Paula. You obviously grew up in a racing family and grew up all around the racetrack. When was the moment you decided this is what you really wanted to do?
You know, I always thought when I was really young that I would be doing something on the racetrack. And then when I got in high school, my whole high school years, I kind of just said, no way, I'm staying. You know, actually, when I was 16, I got a job walking hots for Angel Montano at Ellis Park during the whole summer. And I saved up a good bit of money and bought a car. And then, you know, I did that the next summer. But I never really, during high school, I never thought that I would actually work on the racetrack. I didn't know what direction I was going to go in. But honestly, the day I was staying with friends to graduate high school, my mom was ponying horses at Louisiana Downs, and I was in Illinois, Southern Illinois, and I just needed to get, you know, graduated. And I got on a Greyhound bus the next day and went to Shreveport, Louisiana.
Wow.
And I knew right then. I was, I just knew right then. I mean, I said, well, I'm going to be a jockey. I was a track, you know, I ran track in school, and I was always an athlete, and I just said right then, I'm going to be a jockey. I mean, I thought I was when I was little, and then I got away from it for a while, and then right then I just said, I'm going to be a jockey.
So when you first...
And that's what I did.
So you decided to do it. What was your first move? How did you go about that?
I went to a training track right really close to Louisiana Downs. And, you know, kind of was begging to get on, you know, try to learn. I actually ended up going to, my life has been so crazy. It's just even so hard to explain it on the radio. I had a friend, my mother had a personal close friend named John Phillips. He was a trainer, and his nickname was Stubby, and he lived in Alabama. So I ended up going to Alabama with him and trying to, he got me, you know, some horses to gallop on, quarter horses on the bush farms. Like, you know, they ran the bush races there at Rainbow Downs and all over Mississippi and Alabama. And I got on some horses there, and I had some natural skills, but not the strength, obviously, that you need. And my mom was moving on to Oaklawn Park in Arkansas with her pony business, and so I met her there, and I got a job walking hots for Larry Edwards, who was known to teach people how to gallop. That he had been known for that his whole life. And so I told him, yeah, I want to work for you, but I want to learn to gallop. And so he taught me how to gallop. It was a rough go at first, but he taught me very good. He was a very good teacher, and I learned well, and I learned everything else on the way that was important, you know, from the ground up. I actually ran his barn for 2 years, you know, as an assistant trainer. So I was actually an assistant trainer when I started race riding, and he put me on my first 8 mounts as a jockey. I traveled, you know, from Arkansas to Kentucky. That was our circuit.
Do you think that's important to learn from the ground up and learn how to be around a horse, learn horsemanship skills before you actually get into the saddle?
I think it is so desperately important, and I think it's lacking in most of today's jockeys. You know, I mean, the good thing is a lot of them go to the jockey school in Puerto Rico, and they learn a lot over there. I mean, they teach them how to do a lot. I mean, they don't just ride the horses. They clean stalls and they take care of the horses. But, you know, we don't do that over here anymore. You kind of just throw the person up and here you go. You know, I think my foundation, learning what I learned and, you know, taking, I took 3.5 years to ride. I think that helped me tremendously too. I think taking a long time and really giving yourself a foundation helps also.
Looking back on my own career, Paula, I definitely agree with you. And it's so much better to wait until you're sure you're ready. Looking back, I'm like, wow, I should have waited a little bit longer, but I was too excited. I just wanted to ride. But it's so good to have that foundation. What for you, what was the most difficult thing at first to learn?
You mean like riding a horse?
Yes.
Let me think. The most difficult, you know, the most difficult thing for me to learn when I had to get ready to race ride was the shortness. I galloped for a man that rode long, and he came from, his background was Bill Mott and Jack Bamberg. So, you know, they have a tendency to gallop long, bow their neck, you know, and I worked a lot of horses, but I didn't work them with really short iron. It took me a while to get used to jacking my irons up, you know, really getting close to race riding. I had to really start doing the jockey saddle and everything. That was tough for me. Learning to use my whip and stuff wasn't so hard, but riding short irons in a little tiny saddle, that was a little difficult for me.
Well, they say, Paula, the longer you ride, the longer you ride, so, you know.
That's what they say, and I think it's probably true.
I do, too. I definitely do agree with that. Now, did you have anyone take you under their wing when you were first getting ready to ride as far as other jockeys?
Well, I was actually in a committed long-term relationship with Willie Martinez. I'm sure you guys have heard of him.
Oh,
he was actually leading rider at Churchill and Keeneland when I started riding. So I had a pretty good, you know, I had pretty good advice every day when I went home. I mean, he was a little tough on me, but I mean, he was always right. So I would say that he did. Shane Sellers brought me a saddle. I'd been friends with him for years also, and he brought me my first, I rode in this tiny little saddle my first race, and Shane brought me a really lightweight, bigger saddle and said, use this, please. and gave me, you know, gave me a whip and stuff. And he coached me along pretty good. Those two were probably my biggest influence. I copied Shane. Shane had such an, I liked everything about the way he rode. I wanted to be just like him in a race. I mean, he had a special place for me because I grew up at Fairmont Park, and when I was a kid at Fairmont Park, Shane Sellers came in there and just became, you know, became the leading rider out of nowhere. Beat David Gall, which was unheard of because David Gall was leading rider there for a gazillion years, and I think one meet Shane beat him, and I was like, oh my God, I want to be just like Shane Sellers.
Well, he's such a great guy anyway. He's a very, very nice fellow and very, very thoughtful of others. So I'm not surprised he took care of you.
Yeah, when I started riding, I mean, the jockey colony was freaking unbelievable. I mean, you had Pat Day, you had Willie Martinez, you had Shane Sellers, Jerry Bailey, and the list just goes on from there. I mean, it was just, you know, Mike Smith, everybody that came to Keeneland was just unbelievable. The riders that came, I got to ride with some exceptional riders and you learn a lot.
Oh, I always say, Paula, that it's so much easier to ride a good horse. You learn so much more riding a good horse. And the same is true about the jockey colony you ride with. If you're riding with bad riders, all you do is pick up bad habits and it's not a good situation. But when you ride with the best, I mean, what an opportunity that had to be.
Yes. And, you know, I rode Richard DePass. Are you guys familiar with him?
Oh, yeah.
He took my book when I had the bug. And that's honestly why it took me so long to start riding, because I wasn't going to start riding until I could get Steve Elzey or Richard DePass. They were the two top agents there. And I was bound and determined I was going to have one of them no matter what. And I actually got Richard interested in me. I made him walk up to the rail and watch me work a horse. And he showed me a couple things. And the next horse I worked, I did it, and he's like, man, you're a fast learner. So he was actually losing. Fabio Arguello had the bug and was getting ready to lose it. So he actually took interest in me and decided to work for me. But he sent me to Tampa Bay for the winter, and he came with me. And I had to learn fast because he was a very highly respected agent. Nobody could understand why he was coming to Tampa. And he got me on a ridiculous amount of horses immediately. And they were horses, they weren't always like picked, but they were live horses. And I had to show up and make good decisions, you know, and learn to, you know, I'd only ridden 8 horses when I went there. And, the first day, I think I was named on like 7 in one day, you know, and I was like, oh my God. And they were just, you know, I had to make, like I said, make decisions right away. And people always say, oh, you know, you need to ride 200 horses and practice in the back before. And I don't feel that way. I feel like you learn when you have, you know, when you're on live horses and you have to make decisions, that's when you really learn. When you're back there not going anywhere, you're just kind of not going anywhere, you know?
Exactly. I completely agree with that. When I started out and, like, oh, we'll just throw you on this 50-to-1 shot. You can practice switching sticks. I'm like, no, I really don't want to do that. No, give me a decent
That's
shot.
That's about the only thing that being back there is good for, is you can practice switching sticks. But you know what? When you are fighting for the win and your gut is telling you to go left, go left, go left, and you're trying and you can't, but you're trying, but you feel like you really need to do it, you'll get doing it. You'll get doing it because it costs you the win, and your body, your instincts will just take over, and you'll get it there.
You're exactly right. I remember when I actually got disqualified because I was just trying to do that, just started out, having a tough time switching sticks, and got disqualified. So after that, I went on the Equisizer every single day, and every single horse I'd switch sticks, and then I actually became better hitting left-handed than right-handed, so it worked out well. Worked out well, but you're exactly right, Paula. And tell me, your agent, would he pull you aside after races and kind of go through the replays with you and show you the ropes that way?
Oh, my God, Christina. My agent was obsessed with teaching me. He would stand at the 3/8 pole with binoculars and scream instructions at me around the turn. And then
a little excessive.
Go to the golf cart and go back to the winner's circle where we all unsaddled and follow me all the way back. People thought he was screaming at me every day. They used to get the worst impression. I was like, no, he's not. He's just telling me advice. And he was good about it. He wasn't mean. He was a good teacher. Richard DePasse was an amazing. I still think to this day that he's missed his calling. He should be teaching people how to ride because he taught me so many things. It was unbelievable how fast I could learn from him. I mean, he followed me all the way back to the jock's room. Do this, do that, do this. You know, if you would have done this, you know. Yes, he was a major teacher. Very good, too. And it helped. It sped things up big. Nobody had that. I'd never seen anybody have that, what I had. And it produced results. Because that meet started, like, the 1st of January. And when I left for Keeneland the 1st of March, I'd already won 54 races.
Wow.
So that was pretty crazy.
That's pretty good. And in the meantime, patting Richard DePasse's pockets.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. Well, not really, because we were at Tampa Bay, and the purses back then were like maiden special weight, $5,500. So I really wasn't, he made more money than he thought he would, and so did I. But it was more like he wanted to give me, he really thought he was going to take me and win the Eclipse Award, you know, and it just didn't work out, but.
So you went to Keeneland. You went to Keeneland after Tampa.
Yeah.
How was that? Going from Tampa to Keeneland and the big leagues.
It was so different because everybody rode so much tighter, so much more aggressive, and just, I mean, I was shell shocked. I mean, just really.
And you mentioned you were going. He had intended to go for the Eclipse Award with you. And what happened?
What happened was a person can't really go to Kentucky and win the Eclipse Award. That's what happened. The girl, like Rosemary Holmeister and all those guys, were on the East Coast. They were riding day and night. you know, they were, and the East Coast is way more female friendly, you know, for riders.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just, you know, that I decided I wanted to stay in Kentucky, and that was probably not the right move if you want to. And even Richard said, you know, let me send you east. And I was like, no, I'm a Midwest girl. I'm a country girl. I don't want to go to the east, you know. I had traveled with a filly named Through Flight for Larry Edwards when I was assistant trainer to the, you know, to Monmouth Park. And the hustle and bustle and the whole, you know, and I stayed with her a week. And I was like, I never want to come over here. And I really didn't.
I love Monmouth Park, but I can feel your pain.
How about beach traffic on the weekend, Labor Day weekend? Yeah. Oh, goodness. Yeah, it's. I get it. Well, and you actually, Paul, you grew up in Southern Illinois, right? That's where I grew up, too.
Yeah.
I always tell people, you know, cornfields, and that's about all you're going to find in Southern Illinois. So it definitely a big difference from Southern Illinois to Monmouth Park. So don't blame you for wanting to stay in the Midwest. And obviously Kentucky, I love Kentucky, and Keeneland's amazing. And did you just, so you mostly rode the Midwest circuit then following that?
Yeah, and to be honest, when I lost the bug, I knew that I was in trouble in Kentucky. That's just the facts. I mean, it's just, you know, I could stay there and grind it out, but I wanted to be popular. I wanted to be in the top three at the tracks I went to, and it wasn't even a question for me. I just needed to take a step down, and I went right back to Tampa. And, you know, I hooked up with Don Rice, who was the leading trainer there, and I started riding for him, and I pretty much followed him around the country riding first call. And, you know, I went from there. I was still able to keep the problem. I didn't win a ton of races every year because I went from Tampa, then we had, you know, then to Canterbury, then had a gap to Hoosier, then a big two-month gap back to Tampa. So I had too many gaps in the, you know, so it's not like I'd win 200 races a year or anything, but I made a great living. I you know, I always did very well at the tracks that I went to, and I was very happy doing that.
Jockey Paula Bacon joining us on Jock Talk tonight, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Paula, you traveled around with Don Rice, as you mentioned. Which racetrack was your favorite?
I had two favorites. I loved Canterbury Park. The management, the Randy Sampson, the people that own it, the Sampsons, they were so racetrack horseman friendly. It was something, you know, that you just didn't see everywhere. They catered to you. The place was unbelievable. There were thousands and thousands of people at the races every day. My wind pictures look so cool from there because in the background, there's tons of people, and they'd come up and they'd want to wave in the picture and everything. It was just, and the fans were unbelievable. They just made such a big deal out of you. I loved it there. The area is beautiful. Everything about Canterbury is just lovely. And I always loved Tampa. That was, you know, those two tracks are by far my favorite.
Yeah, Tampa's, there's something about Tampa. It's kind of old school. It's kind of laid back, and the weather's usually pretty good. When I used to work for Keeneland, I'd be sitting in the press box, be snowing outside, and I'd look at those guys walking around Tampa in their shorts. I'd be so jealous. It's a great place to go during the wintertime.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Tampa. Yeah, and, you know, Tampa got, you know, they have Pete Berube who runs Tampa. He's the, I don't know what he is, general manager, I guess is what he is. He's really, he took it to the net, you know, he took it from Maiden Special Weight 5500 on to what it is now. And, you know, he runs a good show there. I mean, does a great job. He's got Allison DeLuca's the racing secretary. She does a good job. And my favorite person in the world, Richard Grunder, is the announcer. He was my agent at Canterbury. How can you get any better?
Oh, wow, that is too funny. Small world, this industry. No, when you rode at Tampa, I know these days Tampa Bay Downs is like one of the most popular places in the winter, and you go there and there's 500 jockeys, and it's tough. It's very tough because everyone wants to head south, and if, you know, you don't want to go to Gulfstream, well, you go to Tampa. Was it that way when you rode there, Paula?
It sure was. It was that way, but it's so much so much more now. I mean, you know, there was always too many jockeys for the amount of horses at Tampa Bay back when I was riding. But there is quadruple that now. I mean, it's so ridiculous now. I mean, there's hundreds of jockeys here now. I don't know where they all come from. I mean, some of them just come from Ocala and ride one a day or this or that. But there's, like, there's probably 50 jockeys here riding every day on a day-in-day basis. And then there's all these ship-in jockeys from everywhere. So, yeah, it's super competitive meet. Tough, tough, tough.
And you're an agent now. Are you an agent at Tampa Bay?
Yes.
How's that going?
It's been going good for the last... I've been an agent since I started in 2011 again, and I've done really well. I enjoy the job way more than I thought I would. And you have so much free time when you're a jockey agent. You know, you go spend your mornings, you go to the draw, and then, you know, basically that's it for you. You know, it's not like a 9-to-5 job where you're sitting at the desk, and it's not like training horses where your day never, ever ends. So I really like it, and I like the riders that I work for.
Well, and you say it's not an all day and 9-to-5 job, but it's not an easy job. I know, you know, they kind of take the heat for a lot of the stuff, you know, from trainers and jockeys, and they're kind of the middleman. And but you having ridden, you have to. I feel like that's a good spot for you to be in. You know what it's like to ride, so you get the jockey's perspective, and that has to help you, I would think.
It does, and like you said, it's not an easy job by any means. It's mentally draining, you know. But like you said, I have a foundation. I rode. I know what the jockeys want and don't want. You try to make them as safe as you can. After being a jockey, you really look for safety, and you try not to, you know, put them on bad horses. If you hear something, you certainly stay away from that one. Or you know, it does help to be a jockey.
Do you,
you're an agent.
Do you stand down at the quarter pole with your binoculars and shout tips?
No, I don't do that.
She doesn't do that.
I'll probably never see that again in my life.
That's a great story.
I love it, Paula. Well, hey, we're going to continue our visit with jockey Paula Bacon after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. Irad Ortiz Jr. had a solid start to the Aqueduct meet after returning from the Breeders' Cup. Ortiz Jr. finished in the money on 62% of his mounts and led North America in earnings. Ortiz Jr. finished the week with 8 wins, 3 seconds, and 7 third place finishes. Jose Ortiz also had a solid week at Aqueduct, highlighted by a win in the Grade 3 Red Smith Handicap aboard Bigger Picture. Ortiz finished the week with 5 wins and 4 second-place finishes. Denny Velasquez shipped into Churchill from Hawthorne and made the most of his lone mount. Velasquez came into Louisville to ride Hay Dakota in the Grade 3 Commonwealth Turf Stakes and managed to upset the field at 29-1. The win on Hay Dakota was Velasquez's first graded stakes win and helped him finish the week with 2 wins and 2 second-place finishes. Finally, the Shuffle Bean Coffee Jockey of the Week, Paco Lopez, had a great Sunshine Millions preview day at Gulfstream Park West. His wins on the card included the $100,000 Juvenile Filly Turf aboard Compelled and the $100,000 Juvenile Filly Sprint aboard Our Angel Caitlin. In the $100,000 Millions Classic preview, Lopez rode heavy favorite Mr. Jordan to a 3 3/4 length victory and set a new track record. Lopez finished the week with 5 wins, 4 seconds, and 2 third-place finishes from only 15 mounts. Ride to Win, an inside look at the jockey's craft, explores everything that goes into winning a race from the rider's perspective. Written by award-winning turf riders Bob Fortas and Gary West, the book explores how jockeys land mounts, how they plan strategy, and what they are doing as a race unfolds. A significant portion of the proceeds go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. For excerpts, testimonials, and to order, visit JockeyTalk360.com. This has been CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 Weekly Update. For all the latest news in the jockey world, visit JockeyTalk360.com and follow us on Twitter at Jockey Talk.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I am Christine McManigal, Jude Feld here. And we're joined tonight by jockey Paula Bacon. Paula, before the break, we were talking about your agent career. And as I mentioned in the introduction, you also trained horses. But I want to go back. What happened during your riding career to make you hang it up?
I actually did something crazy. I went to Tampa Bay Downs every winter and rode for Don Rice. And I happened to skip a Hoosier meet and went to Beulah Park to ride. And I got hurt there. I got flipped over in the gate. And the horse landed on top of me with me standing straight up in the back doors. And the horse landed, like, directly on top of me and compressed, like, 4 of my vertebrae. And fractured my sternum, and I was able to overcome the fractured sternum really fast, but the back thing just was, I was never the same, and I had just a lot of problems, low back problems, and it got so bad that I had to quit for a while and have a treatment called Vax-D, and that helped me a lot, and I came back, I think I was off 6 months that time, and I came back to doing really good, but my left foot was constantly numb and tingling, and I got to where I would have to look down in the gate and make sure my foot was sitting right in the stirrups before we broke, and I was just like, you know what, and the doctors told me that, you know, I was never going to be perfect again, and I said, I had to quit. I wasn't right, I wasn't feeling right, and I knew it was never going to get better, so, not unless I quit, which I have gotten. You know, I'm okay now.
What was that Vax-D treatment you mentioned? What was that about?
That was this treatment. A chiropractor actually recommended it for me, and I was in St. Louis. Well, I was in Southern Illinois at the time, and they had a clinic in St. Louis. It was really new. It's the football players. They had all the NFL, you know, the St. Louis football players were all doing it, and it was a. They lay you on a table, you hold onto these handles, and they put a belt on you, and it's a decompression table, and it spreads apart, and it pulls your, you know, it pulls your hips, and it spread, it allows the blood to rush into your, in between your vertebrae and heal your disc for like a minute at a time. And it was in its infancy then. Wow. But I couldn't stand up straight. I was completely bent over. If a pen fell on the ground and I picked it up, I could feel the weight of the pen in my lower back. That's how bad it was.
Oh,
and I did that for 30 days, and I was riding a week later.
Wow. Impressive.
Very.
It sounds like the rack.
I know. It does. Ugh. Gosh.
I've actually recommended it for people since then, and they've gotten way, the treatment's gotten way better, and people that have done it have come to me and said, you saved my life, you know, and it's not well known. It's kind of strange.
I've never
heard
of it.
It didn't take off, but it certainly worked for me.
Well, I'd say so if you were back riding a week after that, but...
I was. They told me to give it a little more time, but I was ready to go. I felt 3 days after that treatment was done, I was like, I was feeling good. I got on my first horse and got entered on one and was right back on.
We have a lot of jockeys that listen to this show, so they're probably making notes right now.
Yeah.
And jockeys are notorious for coming back so quickly. So that makes sense, Paul. It makes sense.
Oh, God. You're just, you know how it is, Christina. When you're down, you just can't wait for that minute to get back up.
Oh, I used to sit on the couch whenever I had an injury, and I shouldn't have, but I watched TVG, and then I would start throwing things at the TV whenever my horses would win. And I'm, drove me nuts. Did you have any other injuries during your riding career?
I cracked my foot once. Everything that happened to me happened in the starting gate. I cracked my foot. I went down in several spills, but I always walked away from them. I broke my nose once at Hoosier in a bad spill. I didn't have anything real serious. I cracked a rib once. Nothing bad.
Now, you mentioned the starting gate, and we're going to talk about your training career a little bit, but the starting gate, it is so essential to school horses in the gate and get them comfortable in the gate. And were you big on that as a trainer, having experienced bad horses in the starting gate?
Oh, yeah. Huge. I was a huge schooler. I would stand my horses constantly, whether they needed it or not. I believed in going to the starting gate, I mean, thoroughly, because it does make a big difference in, you know, the way they act on race day.
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. And that's where you can win or lose a race, you know? And so you decided to train after your horrible back injury. And what was it like for you to decide to hang it up, that you needed to retire? And how was that mentally? How was that process for you?
It was mentally horrible because I wasn't really ready. You know, I didn't think that there was any way at 30 years old I would be quitting riding. I mean, I just wasn't ready. And I knew I had to do it. I really did. And I convinced myself that's what I had to do. And I actually was a jockey agent for 2 years first before I trained horses. I brought Bobby Walker to Mountaineer Park, and we, you know, had a great run. And I was looking to train horses, though. That's really what I wanted to do. And I had an owner that wanted to have a salary trainer. And someone recommended me for the job, and I ended up getting it. And so that's how I started. And his name was, the owner was named Dave Walters. And so that's how I started.
It's a nice way to start with a private job. You don't have to worry about billing and all that stuff. And
it was the best way to start. And I only lasted with him for 2 months because he built a huge training center there in West Virginia. And it kind of strapped him. And so he got out of the train. He got out of having a trainer for a while, probably a year or so. And I thought I was going to have to quit then. And crazy things happened to me. Wayne Catalano was actually at Mountaineer training horses there with a string, which even sounds crazy, but he was. And he'd been, you know, a friend of my mother's and known me my whole life. And he saw me walking down the street. He said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to the racing office. I have 5 stalls. I'm going to have to turn them in." And back then at Mountaineer, the purses were great, and it was impossible to get stalls. And he was like, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, my owner is not going to have horses for a while." And he's like, "You can't turn your stalls in." And, you know, he said, "Listen, I have some horses for Calabrese here with somebody else." He said, I'll give you these 4 Calabrese horses for those stalls. Will that make you keep your stalls?" And I was like, "For Frank Calabrese?" And he's like, "Yeah." I was like, "Well, yeah." And so Richard Englander was a very good friend of mine and had horses there, and he was looking to make a change. So I called him, and he gave me 3 horses. So I had 7 horses that day. It was kind of crazy. And that's how my career really started, was training for those two people.
7 horses and 5 stalls.
Yeah.
Send you out borrowing.
But that really great training center that Dave Walters built is right where I went. It was great. It had an indoor swimming pool, a track, a Eurosizer, and tons of paddocks. So I just took all my horses out there and shipped into my stall.
That's the way to do it. And with such great connections, my gosh, yeah. I mean, what an opportunity. And and you'd already had a little bit taste of training. And what was your initial thought when you first jumped into that? Was it harder than you thought? Was it what you really thought you really wanted to do? Or what were your thoughts on that?
I thought, you know, being an assistant trainer, that I was really way ahead of the curve. But when I got my own horses to train, it was, you know, a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. A lot scarier, because you have to get over the first hump of every day you walk into the barn and something's wrong with the horse. Mm. You freak out at first because you're not, you know, you're like, oh my God, you know, his ankle's blown up, or this, or that, or that, or that. It's something every day. But you calm down after a few months of that, because you realize most of these little things go away with minor, you know, doing this or that. And it's not always the end of the world every day when something's wrong with a horse. Most of the things that are wrong, you can fix pretty easily. But it's pretty overwhelming at first, because something is always wrong.
You sound like Richard Mandela. Richard Mandela told us, you can bet that when you walk into your barn, there's something wrong. You can never bet that there's going to be something right. He said, you can only bet that there's going to be something wrong. I never looked at it that way when I was training, but I can see where people would get that feeling.
Yeah, I mean, just every day for the first month or so, I mean, I was freaking out completely, because I'm like, oh my God, is it me? Am I cursed? But no, it's just the way it is. I mean, but you learn to pick your battles with yourself, and not to freak out over this and this, because this will be okay and this will be okay. You freak out when something really bad's wrong. Mm.
Well, when the groom says, boss, you better come look at this one, that's like the worst thing you ever want to hear.
I know, but it's like, I happen so much.
Yeah. I'd rather have the owner fire me than hear that.
Yeah.
Well, see, that's the thing, dude. You know, I don't know what that's like. You know, as a jockey, you get a different horse every race, and you can just hand it back to the groom and you don't have to worry about it. And, you know, as a trainer, you're stuck with them, and you're hopefully stuck with them anyway, if they're decent.
Yeah.
And you got to deal with all of those problems and issues. And that has to be just long hours. My gosh, dude, you know, I don't know, but that long hours, hard, tough days, I can't imagine.
Yeah. It's a tough life. I mean, it's a lifestyle, but all of us on the racetrack are familiar with it. And, you know, I think when you get your trainer's license, and that you're in for the long haul. I mean, it's not like, everybody except Doug O'Neill. When Doug O'Neill went to work for me, he thought it was a Monday through Friday job, but he was only in high school. He'd never been on the track before. And when he was going to take off Friday afternoon after work, he said, well, I'll see you guys on Monday. And I said, well, it's a 7-day a week job. He goes, oh, my mom's not going to like that. So I said, well, go home, talk to your mom, and you guys work it out. If you come back Monday, I'll know you're in. If you don't, then we'll catch up with you at Santa Anita. You can work on the weekends again. So, and he was there Monday and stayed, and he's been at it ever since.
I was going to say he must have came back, because now he's Doug O'Neill.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty amazing. But yeah, back in the day, he had no idea.
Didn't even know.
Yeah. Friday, see you guys later. My foreman almost had a heart attack.
Where are you going?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, and Paula, you know, and I've talked to riders who have trained, and they always say that it's always so frustrating when you know how to ride and you give a rider a leg up on a horse and they don't follow instructions, or they're late for works in the morning, or whatever it is. Was that frustrating for you? Did you have very many experiences like that?
With trainers, with me as a trainer giving instructions?
Yeah, with riders. You know that you could do a better job than the jock you put up there.
Yeah, I rode mostly when I was training horses. I rode my jockey agents, whoever, my friends that were jockey agents, I rode their riders. And, you know, I wasn't a big instruction person, because I really didn't like tons of instructions when I rode. I had one weirdo horse that was a really special horse to me. His name was Guardian of the North. And Brett and Lori Rice owned him, and I had won a stake race on their homebred Guardian of the Gate, so this horse was a half, you know, was out of the same mare.
So it was kind of special for me. And he was very difficult to ride. He pulled like crazy, and you had to take a hold of him and take him and get him behind somebody. Because if he got the lead, he could go in 28 for the first quarter. He went 27 one time and got beat. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just would not win on the lead, could not do it.
Wow.
And so that horse I gave instructions to all the time, and people periodically wouldn't listen, and it was frustrating for me. But for the most part, no, I didn't have a problem with them. I just, you know, I rode whoever my owners wanted or the jockey agents, and I didn't put a big issue on the rider. I felt comfortable when I entered a horse if I knew they were going to run good. I felt pretty good about not saying too much, unless the horse just had, you know, like I said, something different, you know. Most horses, though, jockeys look in the program and handicap the race, and they can figure it out.
Well, they do say jockeys make the worst handicappers, so I don't know.
That's they are. They probably are.
Some jockeys are better at reading past performances than others and kind of know where they are. I think Johnny Velasquez is awesome at handicapping a race, but he's a very cerebral guy. You know, he has 3, 4, 5 plans.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you have to, really.
Yeah.
You gotta know. What, but, were you big on instructions, dude?
No, not really. I didn't like them. I knew most jocks didn't like them. And I, being a devotee of Charlie Whittingham, who said the bad jockeys don't listen to him and the good jockeys don't need him, I was kind of like that. Actually, somebody asked me that question during Breeders' Cup, and they said, what did you used to say to jockeys? And I'd say, well, how's your wife? Or, what are you doing this weekend? You got any plans for Monday? You want to play golf this week? Just that kind of stuff, like pleasantries, you know. I never really, like Paula said, if it had a horse with idiosyncrasies, like this horse likes to lean left or not too good in the gate or take her away from the rest of the field and let her relax, that kind of stuff. Sure. You know, just little idiosyncrasy things, that's all.
Yeah, things you need to know.
Yeah, yeah. Or be helpful,
right.
You know.
Right,
be
helpful. We always like a heads up. If
yeah.
I actually work for a jockey now that's been around for a really, really long time, and he does a great job. And he's I've worked for him for 5 years, Ronnie Allen Jr.
Oh, yeah.
And I can tell when somebody gives him instructions because – he will live and die by those instructions. If a trainer gives him specific instructions in the paddock, he will go all in. He'll put his heart and soul into those instructions because he wants to please the person that he's riding for. And sometimes I'll be watching, oh, yep, he got instructions. I always like the way he rides better on his own judgment.
Ronnie Allen Jr. Yeah, I know Ronnie.
He's
know
a very him. Good rider.
Very good rider. Yeah. Very good rider. Rode with him at... him at Tampa. Do you just have Ronnie now?
No, I just picked up Pablo Morales for this meet.
Yes, I know Pablo as well. They have a blast from the past. My goodness. My goodness. And how do you work now as an agent? Are you really, do you go with them to the barns in the morning? Are you really involved in the mornings? Or what's your style? Do you just go to the barns you typically ride for? What's your style in the mornings?
No, I try to spread myself out pretty good in the mornings. You know, I pay a lot of attention to Kathleen O'Connell and Jerry Bennett because obviously those are two people that support me. Tom Proctor, Ian Wilkes, those people support me very heavily. So, you know, of course I see them probably more than anybody, but I try to spread myself out pretty good because you can win for everybody. You know, I mean, there's always winners in everybody's barn.
Is your general style, I always say there's two kinds of agents. There's the ones that try to ride the best horse every race and the ones that try to have relationships with trainers. Which category do you fall into?
I'm 100% a relationship with the trainers. I live and die by the trainers. You know, I show loyalty. They show loyalty to me. That's my style. There's the other style. Mike Moran's the other style, and he seems to always be ahead of me. You know, so I don't know which one works better, but mine works good for me and, you know, his works good for him.
Yeah, I think there's plenty of money for everybody. I mean, when I was training in California, Scotty McClellan had Chris McCarron and Craig O'Brien had Eddie Delahousse. And Craig's very much a stable guy, rides for trainers. And Scotty was like, wanted to ride the favorite in every race because he knew he'd win a third of the races that way. So they had conflicting styles, both great guys. And, you know, both jocks rode for me, but I always preferred Craig's style, except when he had to ride one for Neil Drysdale, and then I got the shaft. But, you know, that's the breaks of the game. But I always liked the fact that if I went to Craig, he would ride the horse, even if maybe it didn't have the best form or whatever. Whereas Scotty, if the horse didn't look like he was going to be the favorite or at least the second choice, I didn't have much chance. So.
No shot.
Yeah. Well, I kind of learned a lot from Jimmy McNerney's agenting style. He's a guy that rides for, you know, trainers. He's a trainer rider, but then also he'll ride the best horse. He kind of has an ebb and flow there, you know, that has been difficult for me to adjust. You know, I just kind of stick with the barns, but he kind of mixes it in both ways, and it obviously works well for him as well as he does in the game.
Well, I think that, you know, back in the day, loyalty was so much more prevalent. You know, you had your barns that jocks just typically rode for. Nowadays, it seems like it's much more so everyone rides for everyone kind of situations. There's not as much loyalty as there used to be back in the day. And I think, as you mentioned, I think it's nice to have your barns you kind of stick with. You get to know the horses as a rider, you know, you ride to... The barn, and I think that's a big advantage too. And you know how the trainer likes you to ride, their style, and I think that's a big advantage.
Yeah, it is. And then you have a guy like Ronnie Ebanks, who's also one of my favorites in the world. He kind of just has such a personality that people just can't get mad at him and kick him out ever. It's like, you might get mad at him for 5 minutes, but he works his way right back in, you know. So you always want to try and copy a little bit off a guy like that too.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. We're joined tonight by jockey Paula Bacon here on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Paula, we're going to rewind a little bit. I wanted to clarify, you were training, and then now we're talking about your agent career. What happened in between there?
I was a jockey agent for 2 years, became a trainer for 7 years, and then have been agenting immediately after that since. So I never had breaks in between. I just went from one right to the other. So there was nothing really in between. I just went right on with it.
Yeah.
So you find you have more of a life now as an agent than you did as a trainer?
Way more. Way, way more. Just, you know, like I go to the gym. I do CrossFit. I can do that. Training horses, there was no way I could make time for that.
No.
You know? I mean, I was always feeding. I had a truck and trailer. I was always hauling a horse somewhere. It was constant.
Is that why you decided to go back to being an agent?
No, I decided to go back to being an agent because, you know, the crash in 2007 and 8 desperately hurt a few of my big clients. I mean, it really hurt Richard Englander, the stock market, and, you know, the whole thing went ugly then. And I got really low on horses, and I was walking down my shed row one day, and I had like 11 horses, and I looked in each stall, and I was like, oh, you can't win because you're not good enough. Your owner's not going to let me drop you. And I went one by one, and I just said, you know what, I can't do this. I don't want to do this like this. I need to have the stock behind me. I need to have the owners behind me, or I don't want to do something halfway. So I said, you know what, I'll take a break. I'm going to take a break. And I'll get back to it, but I just haven't went back, and I don't think I'm going to. Just the way the business is now, it's gotten tougher and tougher to get owners, keep them, good owners. I feel sorry for the trainers. Some of my good friends that are trainers struggle, and they shouldn't because they're sharp and they're good, but it's a tough time for training horses, in my opinion.
What do you think can happen to change that?
You know, the casinos, everyone thought were going to be the answer to all of our prayers, but they really hate the horsemen. They just want to have casinos. They don't want it to be, they don't even want the racetrack there, and they're trying to phase them out, and I think eventually they will. I don't know what the answer to help the horsemen is. I really don't. You know, big tax breaks for people that own horses, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, that might help.
There's
someone.
So much gambling. What's that?
That might help somewhat, some tax breaks and that type of thing. But I think you're spot on about the casinos. They use the horses to get the casinos, and then once they're in, they don't need the horses anymore. I mean, we saw that at Calder.
And they treat you terribly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
They treat you terribly, like really terribly. I mean, they don't care at all. You're a nuisance. They don't do anything to help your industry. They just, you know,
That's how it goes.
They don't need you once they got you, they don't need to help you out anymore. And it's sad. And it's, you know, unfortunately, you don't know really the answer. Like you said, though, some of the smaller tracks that don't have casinos, well, they go under. So it's a bad situation, I guess. And who knows what we can do or what will happen. But anyway, kind of a depressing subject. but anyway, it's not good. But hopefully things come around. And Paul,
this industry's been in trouble before, though, and seems, you know, we always seem to work our way out. But we'll see. I mean, this isn't the first time that horsemen have been down this road. It just seems scarier now than ever.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, it's tough. It's tough, when clients, their businesses go under or whatever, the trainer ends up getting stuck for a big chunk of change, and that's happened to all of us. It's a tough racket. I always think that owners should have to pay first and last, just like when you rent an apartment. Every time they bring you a horse, they should put, $4,000 in the office or whatever. Yeah. Because it's,
I agree. You know, that is a real problem. I mean, you have, and I have carried horses 90, on and on, 90 days plus, without getting paid. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
How can we operate that way? You know,
if somebody gives you a horse on the first, you're paying for the horse's upkeep for a month. You bill them at the end of the month. They take 30 days to pay. Well, now you have 2 months training bill into that horse. So you might as well have been training your own horse, mm-hmm. right? Because that's basically what you're doing. That horse now, they owe you $6,000 or whatever, And that's only if they pay at the end of 30 days, and they may not pay for 90, So now you're up to $9,000, and sometimes the horse is even worth $9,000. So it's
and then you're chasing them.
Yeah, it's a tough racket. Yep.
I can't even imagine. Glad I didn't go that route after my riding career. Glad I didn't go that route.
Yeah, that's why people ask me all the time, would you ever go back to training? And I have people call me and want me to train. And I always say no, because it's really, really difficult unless you're operating at the highest level.
Oh, it has to be incredibly tough. Paula, we have 1 minute left. Real quick question for you. What's next for you? Are you going to stay as an agent?
Yes, I'm going to stay as an agent. I enjoy it. I like it. I like my jockeys, and I'm going to stick with it.
Well, Paula, we are wishing you all of the best, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Folks, you can check out this show and replays of Jock Talk on our website, horseracingradio.net. While you're there, don't forget to check out all of the other great shows you can find on the Horse Racing Radio Network as well. Now be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, Jude Feld, I am Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.